Thanks for listening to Westminster Insider. We'll get started right after this.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Today's episode is presented by Lloyds Banking Group. Everyone deserves a safe place to call home. That's why Lloyds Banking Group is calling for 1 million more homes to be made available for social rent by 2033.
That's the sound of Bondi Beach on a sunny Friday afternoon. You can hear the chatter of tourists, the distant sound of beach volleyball, the dozens of people jogging along the promenade, and the very serious conversation among surfers about where the best break in the swell can be found. This is the kind of Australia that British politicians fantasize about when they dream up policies which are, as they like to say, Australian style. This is the Australia of Home and Away, of Neighbours, of Kylie Minogue. As I recorded this, my brother was waiting, patiently in the car, trying to fend off the various people vying for his parking spot. Bondi Beach parking, by the way, is a politics unto itself. It takes a sharp eye to spot the departing surfers and a truly Australian stubbornness to wait immovably at the front of a queue of impatient motorists. You have to do what you have to do to secure a spot. But even the brutality of Australian beach parking can't compete with the sheer ruthlessness of Australian politics. You can keep your Brexit battles and your Trump-inspired insurrections, your smooth Canadian Liberals and your French revolutions. There is nothing, nothing quite like Aussie politics for endless jaw-dropping moments.
Why won't you call an early election?
Mate, because I want to do you slowly. I want to do you slowly.
Mr. Depp has to either take his dogs back to California or we're going to have to euthanize them.
People are entitled to their sexual proclivities. Let there be a thousand blossoms bloom.
But I ain't spending any time, mate, because every 3 months, a person is torn to pieces by a crocodile in North Queensland.
How do you get bee semen into the country?
The bee semen gets sent in little vials.
Financial commitment of the Commonwealth Government to this shitty city shaping. You've got to be careful with that. I'm sure that'll get a run.
In an earlier episode of this podcast, Jack talked about how he fell in love with Australian politics in the late 2010s, purely through timing. When he was awake in the middle of the night, writing Politico's London Playbook newsletter, Westminster and the rest of his political Twitter feed would all be asleep. But Australian politics was just waking up. And he'd watch the daily madness from Canberra play out on his Twitter feed night after night after night.
The Leader of the Opposition will remove himself from the chamber under 94A.
On the other side of the world, at about the same time, I was working as a journalist too. Young and often lumped with the night shift, I would switch on Prime Minister's questions in the UK to keep me entertained. This was, you could say, one of many cultural exchanges. There seems to be a kind of tradition on this podcast of making your first episode about a particular character trait from your own career. For Jack, it was Playbook and political newsletters. For Alva, it was the lobby. For Aggie, it was the secrets of TV news. And for me, well, for me, it's Australia. Because try as I might, you lot in Westminster will not let me forget it. Just listen to you all. It's Australian style this and Australian style that. It's Australian trade deals and Australian defence deals. It's Aussie advisors and Aussie election gurus.
I've just come back from Australia.
She's a great friend of Australia.
To Australia next.
With arrangements that are more like Australia.
An Australian style point system.
Australia and the UK coming closer together than ever before.
So for my first solo episode of Westminster Insider, I decided to find out, why are you all so obsessed with me? Sorry, I mean Canberra.
It goes to that romance of Australia as a place of land and honey, which in, you know, many respects it is.
Australians at the top of their game, very powerful weapons when filtered into the British system.
Westminster remains intrigued, awed, and slightly terrified of Australia's political culture.
We have a lot in common. When I was last in Britain, I had a very pleasant meeting with the Prime Minister. It's just the natural thing to do.
From Politico, I'm Sasha O'Sullivan. And this week on Westminster Insider, we'll ask just how much we in British politics really borrow from our cousins in Canberra. And if maybe, just maybe, we accidentally imported some of their political turmoil too. October 2021. It was the first Conservative Party conference after the pandemic. Across the country, people were still nervously shuffling around with negative tests and face masks in their pockets. But at the Midland Hotel in Manchester, hundreds of politicos attending Tory conference were crammed in. A 10-minute walk down the road from the conference hotel is Cruise 101, one of the city's busiest gay clubs. There, it was an even tighter fit. Liz Truss, then Foreign Secretary, and George Brandis, then Australian High Commissioner to the UK, and a loyal band of staffers were singing their hearts out to the Human League. Truly, this was the height of British-Australian fascination. Boris Johnson, of course, was still Prime Minister, and Boris Johnson had promised an Australian-style Brexit deal, an Australian-style immigration system, and an Australian trade deal. He had even appointed a very Australian campaign coordinator, Isaac Levito. Boris, we know, loved the country.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the Right Honourable Boris Johnson Bojo.
Well, thank you very much, ScoMo.
But this love story is one with much older roots, and one that certainly seems like it has all the makings of a happily ever after. Okay, quick history lesson. The year is 1901. Australia federates. Pretty young for a country, right? Six separate, self-governing colonies agreed to unite and have one federal parliament based in Canberra. Around the same time, well, okay, fine, 30 years before, the country had just gone crazy. They were in the middle of a series of gold rushes. With the promise of gold came hundreds of thousands of people, some of them even on small boats. Most of them came from Britain or elsewhere in Europe. A country once famed for ex-prisoners roaming free became known instead as a land of opportunity. And while the relationship between Britain and Australia still had that sometimes tense feel of former colonies, during the World Wars, Britain needed us. They needed our troops. And Winston Churchill, that famous Prime Minister, also found a certain Antipodean confidant. His name was Bob Menzies. He was Australia's longest-serving Prime Minister from 1949 to 1966. And man, was he a fan of Britain.
He was from that world that considered themselves British. And he spent a lot of time in London during the Second World War. He and his wife were good friends with the Churchills. Even in retirement, they made him Lord Warden of the Cinque Ports, which was sort of ceremonial.
This is Rowan Watt, former senior political advisor in Liz Truss's Number 10, and a Queensland native.
You look at other sort of former colonies of the UK, we didn't have the messy divorce that that the UK had with America. You look at the civil society structures which set up Australia and the UK, they're extremely similar versus places like Canada and elsewhere. So there's a sort of special relationship that Australia and the UK have.
We have been through a lot together and we have a lot of common values because we went through a lot in world wars and the sacrifices of the Australian troops in World War One and in World War Two, where we joined the conflict immediately, Britain did.
And this is John Howard, the second longest-serving Australian Prime Minister of all time, and kind of the godfather of many of the policies the country is now famous for.
Well, that's very flattering of you to say so. I mean, there are a lot of linkages between Australia and Britain, and particularly between the Conservative Party in Britain and the Liberal Party of Australia.
Crucially, those links between the Tories here in Britain and their Liberal Party equivalent in Australia extend to the sharing of top personnel. Most well-known among them is Lynton Crosby, Howard's famously effective campaign chief, who in the early 2000s traded in Liberal Party politics to become the UK Tories election guru. The so-called Wizard of Oz was so successful in Britain, he received a knighthood from David Cameron in 2015. Crosby was followed by his protege, Isaac Levito, and plenty more behind the scenes. But why? Well, part of it, and this is the episode's first Australianism, is our no bullshit attitude.
Australia is a very Celtic country. We have very strong influences of the Irish and the Scottish. And I think that's given us a very healthy dose of scepticism. We're a little sceptical of people who try and spin us a yarn. I can adopt an Australian expression with which I'm sure you are very familiar.
Over the years, Howard has had numerous serving prime ministers and politicians on the other side of the Pacific calling him up and asking for advice. And now, well, here's me, quizzing him on Zoom.
There was a long period of time when the Liberal Party in Australia, particularly when Menzies was Prime Minister, he just kept winning elections and people thought we must have something special. I had a lot to do with my namesake, Michael Howard, when he was my cousin, as I facetiously call him, when he was the leader of the British Conservative Party and then later on with David Cameron when he became the leader. We have a lot in common. When I was last in Britain, I caught up with a lot of people in the Conservative Party. I had a very pleasant meeting with the Prime Minister.
For many years, these close ties had made for strong historic trading links between the two nations. But as the 20th century rolled on, something happened. A rupture. Britain suddenly had interests closer to home.
Australia was the large trading partner for the UK in the latter half of the 19th century and much of the 20th century.
Rowan Watt again.
I think most of Britain's wool and wheat came from Australia until the 1970s. And what was fascinating was that, well, in the 70s, when Britain joined the EEC, Australia's agricultural exports were basically in trouble. It decimated the agricultural industry in Australia.
Certainly the unified market is a matter of enormous significance. But it is only the first step which will carry us well beyond the questions of tariffs and trade.
If you don't remember those dulcet tones, that's Edward Heath in 1973 announcing Britain's entry into the European Economic Community.
I think Australia's economic success comes a lot from the continental basis. But a lot of the success comes from Britain brutally turning its back on Australia and joining the common market, which was a cultural shock.
This is John McTiernan, former press secretary to Tony Blair in Downing Street, and later director of comms for Australian PM Julia Gillard when she was in office in Canberra. He, like Rowan Watt, is one of a growing line of political advisers who have worked and thrived in both Australia and the UK.
It was a agricultural shock. Agri-foods are still, you know, third or fourth biggest export of the economy. And that caused Australia to change its food culture, change the way it was in the world.
In 1973, Britain made a choice. They had a new club they were a part of, and Australia was on the outs.
I think it's really important to look at the role of geography here.
This is Sophia Gaston. She's head of foreign policy at Policy Exchange in London and a fellow at the National Security College in Canberra.
On the one hand, we are very much a Euro-Atlantic power, and we are obviously then compelled by the forces of geography, which encourage us to develop really important trading partnerships and other types of relationships with our neighbours. And Australia has become a lot more invested in its region, and that was partly out of necessity.
Trade might have gone down, but Australian culture in Britain was on the ascent.
I mean, I think there's more people in Britain who watched Neighbours than in Australia. For example, Australians in their 20s, a lot will come over and work in London for a few years, not only because they feel at home in the UK, so they can do some travel, because we are on the edge of the earth.
The type of Australian that would come during that era was your backpacker type. They were living in Earl's Court, they would pull pints at the pub, and there was a very big bar down in Temple called Walkabout.
This is Latika Bach, an Australian journalist based in London. She writes a kind of online foreign policy bible on UK-Australia relations.
The current crop of politicians who are at the top were brought up on those soap operas, and I think there's a lot of affection and nostalgia for Australian culture.
One of those young Brits consuming Australian soaps every night is now the Shadow Education Secretary.
Oh, I was a big fan of Neighbours and Home and Away. I watched both back to back.
If you haven't already clocked it, this fan is Bridget Phillipson.
We were a family that enjoyed watching soaps. I used to watch it with my grandparents after school. When I was very little, of course, everybody loved Kylie. And all the music output around that time as well.
These strong cultural ties were maintained as the 20th century dawned.
Think about Britain and Australia in the year 2000. The Spice Girls were just sort of peaked in terms of the height of coolness. Australia was hosting the Olympics. Both countries were doing extremely well economically. There's just never been a better time to be Australian or British.
But diplomatic ties were still fraught, to say the least. Things had slumped from a high point of Bob Menzies, who spoke proudly of being British to his bootstraps, swanning around London with the Churchills, to, well, nothing. Basically nothing.
It was the Tony Blair government. There'd actually not been a visit from a UK foreign secretary to Australia for more than a decade.
Journalist Latika Bach.
Now nobody would think of that not happening. We would have talks every year at least, and we would hope to see an Australian minister here every few months at least. You can't ever forget that if you take these relationships for granted, they can be easily, easily forgotten in a busy world.
I was the only Australian Prime Minister that Tony Blair dealt with.
John Howard again.
We got on very well. We were nominally of different politics, but he wasn't as rabid a Labor man as a lot of others were. The relationship has matured in the last 20 years. You don't have the same chip on the shoulder feeling that some Australians used to have. And you don't have this sort of patronising, the colonial attitude that some British people have, which is entirely unmeritorious and not very popular.
Eventually, as all politicians must, Howard succumbed to the whims of the Australian people.
I lost the election and was booted out of politics.
And in swept a period in Australian politics of turmoil, of backstabbing, of what are known down under as leadership spills. And trust me, our leadership spills make the UK Tory party look like a nest of singing birds.
I asked my colleagues to make a leadership change.
Look, it's not fun to go through your own decapitation.
A little while ago, I met with the Prime Minister and advised him that I would be challenging him for the leadership of the Liberal Party.
Clearly, there's a hole that needs to be filled by applause and approval.
I haven't seen Julia's university qualifications as a psychoanalyst.
Just dumbstruck and so appalled by the conduct of the last week.
Okay, let me see if even I can get this right. After John Howard came Kevin Rudd, and then Kevin Rudd was stabbed in the back by his own party, who brought in Julia Gillard to replace him. But then she started flagging in the polls, so they got rid of Gillard and brought Kevin Rudd back. But then he lost the election, so Tony Abbott becomes Prime Minister. Except then his party decides they wanted someone else, so they turf Abbott out and bring Malcolm Turnbull in. And then Turnbull himself was a victim of yet another backstabbing plot, and he gets thrown out as well. And then, sorry, I'm still not done, came Scott Morrison, who won what was thought to be an unwinnable election in 2019. In a period of 11 years, there were 6 prime ministers. Onlookers from across the world in Westminster were, to say the least, bemused. Their time would come, but of course, they didn't know that then.
It was a really ugly, frenetic, crazy time in Australian politics, and Australian politics is still paying the price for that a decade on.
The lesson of the Gillard-Rudd years is the one that Isaac Levito told the Tory party, the 1932 committee last week: divided parties lose elections.
And while Australian politics was figuring its differences out, Britain was squeezing a spot that had been there for decades.
The big message is we have triggered Article 50. We have passed the point of no return. We are leaving the European Union. We've won the war.
This was the moment the UK realised it might have been a little hasty to turn away from its Antipodean allies. After the break, we'll be back for the new dawn of this friendship. Stay with us.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A message from Lloyds Banking Group. Lloyds Banking Group has been a champion of social housing for decades. And since 2018, it has provided more than £17 billion to the sector. Working with Crisis, the national charity for people experiencing homelessness, Lloyds Banking Group is campaigning for 1 million more homes for social rent to be made available over the next decade. Affordable, sustainable, and high-quality homes are the foundation of a healthy society and prosperous economy. Yet it is estimated that more than 8.5 million people in the UK cannot access the housing they need. Find out more about why this is so important and how it contributes to Lloyds Banking Group's commitment to helping Britain prosper at lloydsbankinggroup.com.
We're into the 2020s. Britain's friends across the channel are, well, now firmly frenemies. Boris Johnson is Prime Minister, and he's managed, just, to eke out a European trade deal enough of his MPs will be happy with. At least by his own measure, he's got Brexit done. He's taken back control. Now Johnson just has to prove it was all worth it. This was going to be global Britain. All he had to do was sign a couple of trade deals. Easy, right? And Australia was the first country he turned to.
We send you penguins, and you send us, with reduced tariffs, these wonderful Arnott's Tim Tams. How long can the British people be deprived of the opportunity to have Arnott's Tim Tams at a reasonable price? Let's get this free trade agreement done. Australia and the UK coming closer together than ever before.
Dealing with Australians is extremely easy. I mean, the free trade deal that was recently completed between Australia and the UK.
Here's Rowan Watt again, formerly of Number 10.
Liz Truss was pretty much like, if you can't make a deal with the Aussies, who can you really make one with? It was extremely symbolic and extremely important. And I think Australia understood that when they came to the negotiating table. And there were a lot of, let's say, upset stakeholders in a lot of Britain's agricultural, you know, exporters.
Angry farmers. The British farmers were angry for a reason. They were terrified of cheap, high-quality Australian meat flooding the UK market. And they were lobbying British politicians hard. So, in the run-up to the free trade deal, the Australian High Commission had been running a very Australian charm offensive in Westminster. It was fun, it was friendly, and naturally, it was booze-heavy. And a Conservative government keen to burnish its global Britain credentials fell into its open arms.
They knew how to get things done in Westminster, and it was a very effective time. If I remember correctly, there were party pies and mince slices, there was Australian beers and Australian gins and things like that. And look, diplomacy often happens in the, you know, the quiet, dark corners of events.
And if you think about a lot of the ways that Australia has kind of exercised its soft power here in Westminster.
Sophia Gaston again.
It's always, you know, tapping into those things that people really associate with Australia in a kind of, sometimes in a kind of stereotypical sense, but otherwise, you know, things like the food, the wine, you know, you can't bring the sunshine here, but you can bring the fruits of its labours.
One of my own colleagues here, Graham Langtree, spent months talking to people who had worked on that UK-Australia trade deal of 2021. Graham wrote this incredible article for Politico last year, piecing together just how the whole thing came about. The deal, he discovered, had culminated in a high-stakes dinner between two prime ministers in Number 10.
Boris Johnson had this meeting or dinner over Welsh lamb and all kinds of other British delicacies with Scott Morrison and Lord Frost and George Brandis and some of their retainers there as well. And it got pretty boozy.
George Brandis, the very same Australian High Commissioner who danced the night away at that gay nightclub in Manchester, was prepared for what a night of Australian wine might enable him to squeeze out of Boris Johnson.
The Australians were very canny. They knew all the pressure points that they would need to and buttons to press on Boris Johnson. And George Brandis excused himself from the table and he was going to go to the washroom. And then as he was leaving the dinner, he passed a note that had been scribbled on a little piece of paper. He passed that to the aide and then they very quickly scanned that, sent it to the Australian High Commission, where there was a trade advisor there who then put it into a legal document. And then as George Brandis was coming back from the washroom, an aide had printed it out. And later during the dinner, they presented this to Boris Johnson saying, why not sign right now? And he did.
So that happened basically in the space of time that George Brandis was in the bathroom. So what, 10 minutes?
I have no idea how long it takes George Brandis to go to the washroom. But I would imagine not very long.
So the Australian team were ready for this. They already had this sense that we can get Boris to do this at this dinner.
They did.
The relationships forged during those trade negotiations were instrumental in creating a new connective tissue between Australian diplomats and the UK government. Key figures from Australian politics, like Tony Abbott, got jobs as trade advisors here in the UK. At the same time as Boris was dining out on the free trade deal, the UK and Australia had signed another pact, this time with the United States. An ally Britain was all too eager to impress.
Supreme example of global Britain in action, of something daring and brilliant that would simply not have happened if we'd remained in the EU. I give you AUKUS.
AUKUS is basically a massive three-way defence partnership in the Pacific between Britain, America, and Australia. all three nations have their eyes closely trained on the growing threat from China.
Australia is going to be one of our most important gateways into the Indo-Pacific region. And for Australia, Britain is a really important gateway to the Euro-Atlantic region and access and influence within that community.
There's also the threat of a more volatile friend in that oh-so-special relationship with the US.
For both of us, the United States is our most vital security ally. And I think there's an opportunity and a necessity in there. The reality is that we are, through AUKUS and a range of other different forms of security cooperation, going to be somewhat vulnerable to the headwinds of American political turbulence and dysfunction.
In addition to forging new trade and security partnerships, post-Brexit Britain was also trying to tackle its migration problem. In 2016, Take Back Control had been slapped on buses, on banner advertisements, and repeated interview after interview. But the boats still kept coming. Once again, Britain turned to Australia for inspiration.
You could not walk around Westminster and you could not use the phrase Australian style enough. Because, look, things in Australia do work well. We have a points-based immigration system in Australia. It works reasonably well. It was introduced in the UK, you know, Australian-style immigration, points-based immigration system. You know, brand Australia is strong. People look at Australia, they see it, you know, people are happy and cheery and tanned and bronzed and outdoorsy. And there is a vision of Australia as being this sort of idyllic place.
So for British politicians, this was kind of a selling point. It was this idealized version of Australia. It was the version of Australia I was living out when I was climbing into my car down at Bondi Beach. To some, it was also a way of softening quite hard-line policies on issues like immigration to make them palatable. But are Australian-style policies really so transferable to the UK? Here's John McTiernan.
The Australian population divide the resource of a continent between themselves. So if we want an Australian-style Brexit, for us, it would be that we cleared everybody off the continent of Europe and Britain moved there. And then we use the entire resources from Spain to Hungary and from, you know, it's like, it's that misunderstanding of how underlyingly wealthy Australia is, and particularly minerals. I know why people cite Australia in British politics, and I know why people love Australia, because I do. It's a great country. But the more you know, the less you think it can be just transferred over.
The author of Modern Australian Immigration Policy is, of course, John Howard. He's 75 now. And sitting in his armchair in a well-to-do Sydney suburb overlooking the harbour, he could be your kindly relative. But when he was Prime Minister, he was brutally effective. I have to admit, I still had single digits on my birthday cards when he was running the country. But those slightly older than myself describe him as ruthless when he was administering highly controversial policies. First, he risked his premiership to outlaw guns in Australia back in the 90s. And then came his famous pledge to control Australia's borders and stop illegal immigration.
I would not like Australia to surrender its control over migration and things like that.
Can we talk a little bit about the immigration policies which have come up in the UK? You had that famous line.
But we will decide who comes to this country and the circumstances in which they come.
Well, I thought it was what everybody felt. Look, the Australians are happy to support the high level of migration, providing they feel the migration program is properly controlled. When it gets out of control, they get nervous and say, let's not have as many migrants.
What do you think about the UK trying to replicate what was essentially your original policy?
It essentially got to separate the asylum seeker policy from the general immigration policy. And I think our policy, when we had a problem with asylum seekers, worked well. There's a lot of international criticism, but the Australian public liked it. And I've talked to many British political figures, particularly on the Conservative side, but not totally on the Conservative side, and they understand that it works.
In hindsight, he's almost nonchalant about how successful he was in getting what he wanted. He said he'd stop the boats, and for a while at least, they stopped. But at the time, Howard faced many of the same criticisms Rishi Sunak is coming up against now.
I understand what he's up to and I sympathise with it, but it's pretty tough. You've got the pressure of international organisations, you've got the human rights lobby, and it galls me a bit that a country that's had a pretty good human rights record, which is Britain, gets election.
Were there similar concerns when you introduced it?
Oh, yes, there is similar. We were told we were making Australia unpopular around the world. We weren't, actually. A lot of people understood what we were trying to do. The important thing was to stick to our guns, and I hope Rishi does that.
20-odd years on, the Australian approach to stopping migrant boats remains pretty divisive. Some people hail it as a triumph. Others see it as the start of something insidious in the Western approach to migration. But one former Prime Minister, at least, is in no doubt.
We have in this room a man who prevailed against all the doubters and all the legal contortionists. To quote him, John Howard, just in case you're not following, we decide who comes to this country and the conditions under which they come here.
Many, however, have been sceptical of Britain's ability to copy and paste an Australian-made policy onto Britain. John McTiernan again.
The thing is, you can swim the channel. You can't swim to Australia, right? That's the simplest way of putting it.
This could make or break the next election. Rishi Sunak, obviously, hopes it will be in his favour. And this will be the wedge issue between him and the Labour Party. But it might not be so simple.
I think applying stop the boats into the UK is a mistake.
Latika Burke again.
Australia did run this campaign slogan. It was Tony Abbott in 2013, a Liberal leader, Conservative. And he did win an election and he did go on to stop the boats. Australia can stop the boats because it's surrounded by international waters. And it undertook really extreme measures, which were basically going and intercepting asylum seeker boats, putting them onto lifeboats, dragging them to the edge of international waters with Indonesia, giving them enough fuel, and so they would make shore in Java. Now, Britain does not have those options available to it. So can it actually stop the boats? So running on an absolutist slogan like that leaves you very little wriggle room if you have not stopped the boats come the time of the election.
Nevertheless, Sunak's Conservatives have worked hard to make immigration and his own Stop the Boats pledge a central part of this year's UK election campaign.
I think it's undeniable that migration is going to be an issue in this election, as it is across Europe, as it is in the United States. I think it's a little bit naive to think that the Conservatives wouldn't want to run on this issue, because what they will be hoping is a replica of what happened in Australia over many elections, where the Labor Party and its base feels deeply uncomfortable about running very hard anti-migration lines or even controlling border lines. And we saw that during Brexit here. And that is the trap that the Conservatives will be hoping that Keir Starmer and Labor here fall into.
This trap is one all too familiar to Isaac Levito. Remember him? He's the Australian campaign strategist behind Rishi Sunak. He's now leading that long line of Antipodean spinners that started with Lynton Crosby.
And Lynton always reminded me of how John Howard stuck to a simple message of his philosophy.
The Crosby Texter firm that brought a style of campaigning to the UK that was not only different but highly successful. And that, I think, has left a legacy in UK politics where there's a tendency to look to the Southern Hemisphere for perhaps trends and solutions and ways of communicating that maybe the British don't think about themselves.
How do you mean it was different?
Australians are extremely clear and direct communicators. That does lead to some cultural issues I have found as an Australian working in Britain sometimes. When it gets going in campaign mode, you have this ability to distill messages in a way that the British sometimes aren't capable of doing themselves.
the Crosby Textor firm have said they're now tapped out of British and Australian elections. One insider told me, you get all of the pain and none of the payoff. But the success of Crosby and then Levito gave others with an Aussie twang a leg up when it came to getting a gig in Westminster. Here's Rowan Watt again.
You come in with an Australian accent, and frankly, there is a preconceived notion of you're an Australian working in Westminster. They associate you with other Australians who are doing great things at Westminster.
Now, that's not to say all Australians working in British politics have been successful. I heard one story of an Australian staffer being hired on the misguided basis that they, like their compatriots, would be an electoral genius, only for them to be banished to the boot room of a Grimsby fish market. But given the turbulence of British politics these past few years, these Aussie campaign strategists are at least now working in a setting which is familiar to them.
Britain had gone Australia, hold my beer. Let me show you how it's done. I mean, to Australia's credit, we never had a prime minister in for 44 days.
I think Brexit has instituted an erosion of discipline and convention.
That's Sophia Gaston again.
And it's been a bit more like the Wild West for the past decade as a result. Our politics, our political rhetoric has become much coarser. And that's a sort of style of politics that does feel a little bit more comfortable in the Australian context than compared to what we were used to here in the UK.
But there's something else.
Australia only has 3-year political terms, so you are kind of in a constant feeling of campaign.
When Bill Shorten ran a union, he made deals stripping pay from workers and took secret payments. If union members couldn't trust him with their money, how can you trust him with yours? Labour, it's the bill Australia can't afford.
And I do think that British politics over the past decade has increasingly felt preoccupied with political campaigning.
So the parties are in constant campaign mode and they're thinking, you guys know how to do this.
Precisely. The Australian system is seen to be in constant campaign mode and also a system in which anything is possible and in which engaging with dirty tricks, I think, is seen to be fair game. All of that was really absorbed in the British system.
Now, look, this way of working, the Australian method of campaigning, if you will, it may have won elections, but it has also won some enemies. Over the last few years, we've seen any number of people say, okay, you can win, but can you govern? And actually, there are some voices, especially the kind of old Blairites, who would say baking in some of the rough and tumble of Australian politics into our own system has done more harm than good. Eventually, the goal of politics is to win elections and then fade into the background a little bit so voters can live their lives without, frankly, worrying about what's happening in Westminster, let alone being actively embarrassed by it.
Voters just want the noise to stop.
John McTiernan again.
And they thought the Rudd Gillard, Rudd noise would stop once Labour on the back benches and the opposition benches. And I think the voters think that now about the Tories. It's just like, when will the noise stop? When you've gone, okay. But if I want to explain what happened in Australia, you don't need to go into any detail. You just say, disunity is death.
This makes the lesson for Labour all the more valuable. Last year, Keir Starmer even flew over his very own Aussie spinner to help with the local elections. David Nelson, a political strategist described to me as very Australian, whatever that means. He's apparently spent a lot of time in Labour HQ recently. His colleague back home, Paul Erickson, is the General Secretary of the National Labour Party in Australia and has been giving regular briefings to UK Labour, to the extent that one staffer said he hears Morgan McSweeney, Starmer's head honcho, mimicking Erickson's turn of phrase.
There have been really good relationships between Labour Party staff here and the Australian team and people working between both nations. I think that's also allowed us to finesse our campaigning techniques, look at new ways of doing things, how we speak to voters, how we engage with voters.
That's Labour's Shadow Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, again. In the last year, multiple Labour ministers have flown out to Australia to see how their successful policies from health to childcare have worked and to see if they can copy their election playbook.
It was a very short visit, all things considered, so 4 days.
Okay.
So quite a tight visit. We packed a lot in. I went out to speak at a conference, but also to see what they're doing in delivering their childcare commitments that they made as part of that election-winning manifesto, to meet with Australian Labour colleagues and to see how they're bringing to life a very exciting agenda about what Labour can do to deliver for families.
She made the long, exhausting journey to compare Australia's approach to childcare, both in terms of policy and how to sell it in a campaign.
I had the opportunity to meet with the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, and also just to see it firsthand how exhilarating it was, really, for a Labour government to have won an election with such a positive offer, but to be bringing that to life.
And what was your experience like of talking to them about childcare and how important it was for their election and therefore how important it might be for this election?
They believed it was important both in terms of addressing the cost of living challenge that families there are facing, just as is the case here in Britain, but also how it allowed them to tell a positive story about the direction of their country, about the economy and growth.
Basically, when people start to get older, they settle down, they have kids, and so the political legend goes, they start to vote Conservative. Labour seems to be hoping they can tap into those late 30-something-year-olds or people in their early 40s to bring them on side. This is exactly what Australian Labour did.
They're the very people that, in many of our target seats, are really concerned about lack of access to childcare, about how it is making it hard to combine work and family life. That was a really strong message that they delivered over in Australia.
While she was there, Phillipson had a chance to watch Question Time, Canberra's daily version of PMQs. Yep, I said daily.
Order! Mr. Speaker, give him a Valium. Give him a Valium, Mr. Speaker. He needs it.
The Leader of the Opposition will remove himself from the chamber under 94A.
Rings and sprockets all over the building.
Are you accepting it?
No, of course not. It's rubbish.
The government is not accepting it.
We'll pick it up in 2 weeks' time.
Order!
Many was quite a similar political culture, quite a robust parliamentary sessions, very similar to ours in terms of the building itself, the layout, the nature of the debate, and it happens every day, which must be absolutely exhausting. It was even more shouty and angry and adversarial than our own PMQs, if anyone believed that could be possible.
This political culture is what the UK Labour Party are hoping could help them win the next election.
The reason that David Nelson and Paul Erickson are really important advisors to UK Labour is that they are very, very, very smart.
John McTiernan again.
They're very good campaigners. They're very thoughtful, they're very reflective, and they learn from other people's elections too. They learn from European ones, they learn from American ones, and so David and Paul, they're laser-like about great strategies, are scrupulous about the actual reality of what's going on, the actual options that you have, and then you have a strategy and you execute it brutally.
Okay, this might be a little too risque for this podcast, but when I told an Australian politico that UK Labour was looking to Canberra to secure an electoral victory, she laughed. She said, it's pretty ironic, because Australian Labour literally won by a bee's dick. By the time Anthony Albanese came along, the Australian Liberals had been in power since 2010. They had torn themselves to shreds and lost a lot of good faith. Even then, Albanese only won on a knife edge and found themselves in a precarious position in terms of actually governing.
It says a lot about our great country that the son of a single mum who was a disability pensioner can stand before you tonight as Australia's Prime Minister.
Not dissimilar to the Conservatives here in Britain, they won the campaign, but struggled to hit their stride in government. When I put this to a Labour staffer who's done a bit of buttering up to the Aussies, they said they would take winning, even if it was only by a bee's dick.
That's an Australian way to put it.
Latika Burke again.
I think this is also a mistake. And this is the one thing I would say. There is this tendency in the UK to say, hey, we're looking at Australia with fascination. Maybe we can replicate some of those winning formulas. These are mistakes for the UK to make. Australia is a very different society to the British. Australia is not generally as progressive. And I think sometimes this tendency in the UK to copy Australia is a bit of a folly, because you cannot put one society onto the other. And I have actually written a piece about this, warning that Keir Starmer's micro-target strategy, whereby you literally promise to do all the things that Conservatives would do on national security, on border control, on migration, on the economy. Sound familiar? This is exactly what Anthony Albanese did in Australia. 18 months in, Anthony Albanese finds himself in the position where he has not a lot of mandate.
But the UK Labour Party are looking for an example to follow, and they've turned to Australian Labour.
The commitments that they made were very focused, very specific, but with a clear plan to make that all happen and bring it to life. And I took that away in terms of the approach that we're taking and how it allows parties of the left in particular to make the case to voters.
For Keir Starmer's Labour Party, a party which hasn't been in office since 2010, a chance to hold the keys to Downing Street is pretty much, it seems, all they are asking for. And if they can learn that lesson from Australia, they will. One insider said it's really the tale of two elections. 2019, where Australian Labour lost the unlosable election. And 2022, where they finally got through, but only by a whisker. UK Labour wants to make sure they're the latter, not the former. But perhaps there's reason to be wary of borrowing too much from the Australian example. Almost everyone I spoke to for this episode brought up immigration, which is probably one of the first things you think of when you conjure up Australian politics. The toxicity of this debate has, for the moment, died down in Australia, but it's not without its scars. And the turmoil of all of those leadership spills, all that backbiting, all those different prime ministers, has hardly left the country unscathed. These days, nobody associates Australia with sensible politics or with strong and stable leadership. And given the past few years here in Westminster, maybe that's the lesson Britain needs to learn from down under. Thanks for listening to Westminster Insider with me, Sasha O'Sullivan. If you've enjoyed it, please spread the word, follow us, and maybe leave us a nice review. And please don't forget you can go back and listen to old episodes, like Aggie's on the secrets of TV news from season 9.
You really should. It's very good.
And Aggie is here with us. How did she get here?
Hello. Sasha, I absolutely loved your episode. What an amazing debut. You should be very proud. I now desperately, desperately want to go to Australia. But I have to say, the cherry on top of a very delicious cake was Graham Langtree talking about the trade deal and how long it takes George Brandis to go to the toilet. It was just fantastic.
It's a philosophical thought I've never wanted to complete. But Aggie, you're back next week.
I'm back next week.
What are you talking about?
So I am doing an episode for next week on leaking. So obviously, everyone that ever wants to be a journalist, I assume, thinks that when you get into journalism, you're basically an MI6 spy slash detective rolled into one, and you get leaked all of these materials under the table, and it's all very exciting. So I'm going to hear from people that actually have got stories that are like that. So I have very much enjoyed making it, and I hope people will tune into it next week.
Amazing. I can't wait to listen. My producers this week were John Rogers and Robert Nicholson of Whistledown Productions. And here at Politico, my executive producer is Christina Gonzalez and my editor is Jack Blanchard. Aggie will be back next week. See you then.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.